Well, good morning, everybody. I'm Bill Kovarik. It's great to see you here today. Gifted orator though I may well be, my voice is not up to the morning, so you'll hear less of me than you probably, and that probably won't be a problem. This is a... I'm happy and honored to present this panel to you. It's a wonderful subject and also an area for great story ideas that involves people, communities, children. It's one of the best things that we do. So it's one of the main reasons, it's one of the best topic areas to go into if you need to follow something that involves your community. And that's one reason why we do it. Citizen science, of course, is education, empowerment, accuracy, more data, motivation for citizens, and great things happen. So they're wonderful stories. It's not necessarily new. Historically, of course, we have always had citizens who were scientists, and it's only with advanced training in the 19th and 20th centuries that we've had more or less that distinction. But today, the great thing is that people get a sense of participation from getting involved in things like the Audubon bird count every year, which is one of the well-known citizen science efforts, or a sense of empowerment from things like the Louisiana Bucket Brigade, which is chemical testing by citizens in Louisiana. And those guys are going to be prominent on next year's program in New Orleans. We thought about bringing them here, and then we thought, let's make sure that they're highlighted in New Orleans. And then finally, you know, it wouldn't be a bad idea to leave the door open, but that's okay. Just so people can be coming in and seeing what's going on and we can make sure. And then finally, of course, crowdsourced information can broaden the data. We have three distinguished practitioners or observers of citizen science with us here today. In the middle, I'll start with on my immediate left, is Dave Manthos. He's with Outreach and Communications. He's the director at SkyTruth, and he has a degree from Bucknell in geography and environmental science. Twangi Kasoma, who's going to go first, worked as a reporter in Zambia, earned her PhD at the University of Oregon, has served on the faculty of Emory and Henry, and recently joined my faculty at Radford University. We're very happy that she's there. And she organized a science writers conference in Zambia last year, 2012, which wasn't well known on this side of the Atlantic, but was very well known in Africa and Europe, and so is working with SJ now also to expand our international connections, of course, along with James Fawn, who's here in the audience. And then Aaron Savage, a water quality specialist at Appalachian Voices, and her master's is in environmental science from the Yale School of Forestry. She's been there for about 2 years now. So we will go ahead and start with Twangi Kasoma.
Actually, we changed it up on
you. Oh, you guys, this is the staff revolt.
I'm not even present to that.
No, I missed that. So how should we proceed?
I'll go first, and then Aaron will follow, and Twangi will finish up.
I think that's great. Okay, good.
Okay. All right. Sorry about that change up. I represent SkyTruth. We're a nonprofit that's based in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, and we use two basic technologies to look at environmental issues. That's remote sensing, images and data that are collected by satellites or aircraft. There are other definitions of that term, but it's the kind that we use. And combining that with mapping spatial information, be that information that's collected in the field by citizen scientists, or official reports of pollution incidents, or natural phenomena such as the weather track of Tropical Storm Karen coming up through the Gulf, combining that with the map of oil and gas infrastructure in the Gulf that's under threat. We do combine all of those pieces into the idea of seeing the bigger picture of environmental issues. And how that ties into citizen science, it's been a long road to get to where we are right now, but we imagine a sky-truthing movement where the data and the images that we use are accessible to the public. a decade or even less ago, it would require extremely advanced technical experience just to open a satellite image. Not to be able to do anything with it, understand what you're looking at, but just to have the technical skill to open it and have it on a computer screen in front of you would take technical skill to get that into an interface you could use. But now those barriers are breaking down, and we believe that with modern technology and by presenting this bigger picture of environmental issues, we can engage the public, and that our sky truthing would be a different approach to citizen science. A lot of citizen science is very boots on the ground. It's people getting out in the field, reporting on incidents that have been observed, making observations about wildlife. It's been that sort of thing. But take, for example, New York State is very active in the issue of unconventional drilling and hydraulic fracturing in the Marcellus Shale. They're very concerned about that issue. But many of the people that are concerned about that are in the urban areas. They're on Manhattan. And what's someone to do if they're questioning, is this a good or bad thing? Or what can I do to understand the issue better? Even if they can get out of the city and go to the areas that are at risk, the best that they can do is some baseline monitoring in advance. There are a lot of groups that are already doing that with local citizens. So we imagine almost an armchair citizen scientist, someone that can access the information, the resources we use, and do that from the comfort of their own home. Or one example I'll show you, someone in Tokyo, Japan, processing images for us of hydraulic fracturing activity in Pennsylvania. Because we believe that if people can see what's happening in the world, they can start to understand it and take action to change it. The best example of that is actually the formation of Sky Truth. The founder was working as a consultant for a satellite image analysis company, and a lot of the clients there were oil and gas operators or mineral extraction, very geology-focused. That was his background, as what we focus on mostly. Natural resource extraction, oil and gas drilling, mining, and to some extent now we're getting into offshore or illegal fishing, the commercial harvesting of the oceans. But he was seeing major logging. He was seeing massive developments of wilderness areas for oil and gas development. He was seeing oil slicks and spills on satellite and aerial images and being, what if people could see this and if they could understand what that impact is? And so that led to Sky Truth, and for a while we operated in a very expert analysis perspective. We were providing information for other nonprofits that had a specific question, and we could help them do that. But one thing that pushed us into the forefront and really gave an example to the public of what remote sensing can do was the BP oil spill in 2010. It was not just saying, here you can see it from space, look at how big of an issue it is. It was also challenging the information available at the time about the size of the spill. Because looking at a satellite image, you can delineate how much area is impacted, where you see the oil, and then assume the minimum thinness that it could possibly be that could be detected on a satellite image. This big example, the black and white one, is a radar satellite image. At 1 micron thick over all of that area, you can come up with a volume, and you compare that day by day by day, and you come up with a very conservative estimate of the rate of flow. It doesn't account for what's being burned off, what's being skimmed up, places where the oil is thicker than what we're assuming, but it gives a conservative estimate, and the first number we produced was 5 times larger than BP's estimate, 5,000 barrels a day as opposed to 1,000 barrels a day. Eventually, we increased that to 26,500 barrels a day as our estimate of what the amount flowing out of that well was. In actuality, it turned out to be 60,000 reducing to 50,000 barrels a day over the course of the spill. But this example really put out how getting the view from above would allow people to understand environmental issues. But it's not just disasters. It's not just catastrophic incidents like the spill. It's systemic activity. This was one of the images that actually motivated the creation of Sky Truth. One of our early projects was on natural gas development in the Pinedale Anticline, Wyoming's Green River Valley. It's a very otherwise unoccupied landscape. I mean, you have the red is vegetation as detected by Landsat this year. The grayish blue is pretty much sagebrush, wilderness area. This whole area, though, happens to be an important migration route. And all of the white spots, that spider web of development, is the, by nature, very dense development of unconventional drilling. And so being able to see this kind of development was also very compelling. And it could be seen from the air as well, from an aircraft, just to produce an image. And the one on the right is very well circulated when talking about unconventional drilling, because it just shows you the landscape going off into the wilderness, and it's just pad after pad after pad. But in the east, it's not quite so obvious. If you can advance one step. The well pads are equally big, or maybe even larger, because they're having to reform the hilltops in Wetzel County, West Virginia. Next one. But when you look at it in the same perspective from an aircraft, you really can't see much of anything. I'm not sure why the image is quite as dark as it is, but beyond a couple ridgetops, I can't tell the difference between a farmer's field and a hilltop that's been cleared for drilling. So that kind of image doesn't always work. Sometimes you have to get more detail, and that requires looking at more images. And so this is the first example of crowdsourcing image analysis that we've done. We just completed it last month, and the results were phenomenal. We took the imagery that's available in Google Maps. Is maybe a surprise. It's not satellite imagery, most of it. It's actually an aerial survey that's conducted every 2 to 3 years by the Department of Agriculture for each state. Pennsylvania, during the course of active development, had a survey in 2005, 2008, and 2010. So we looked at the data from the state of Pennsylvania that was saying, here's where every permit is for drilling. But not every permit is drilled right away. We wanted to know when that actually appeared in the real world. So we took those permit locations and said, all right, here's approximately 3,000 sites that are permitted to be developed. We combined that with the NAIP imagery, cut about a 300 by 300 meter chunk around it, and then put it in this interface to say, all right, tell us what you see. Just go through all these images and let us know, is there a pad there at all? If there is it empty? I would actually call this pad empty because there's a few bits of equipment there. Actually, you can go back a second. It's not... This one is active drilling. You can actually see the shadow of the rig on the left side of the screen. Back to the original. And we just put this out to the crowd, basically. We were able to put that out and say, help us do this. And there was a phenomenal response. We had 90,000 images to go through, 3,000 sites in Pennsylvania, 3 years. And because we're asking the crowd to look at this, we have to ask them to look at it again and again and again to make sure somebody's finger doesn't slip or they don't get the wrong one, to see where the crowd agrees. So we had the crowd look at it 10 times. So 90,000 tasks to go through. And we completed the project in 29 days. And as I mentioned earlier, one individual from Tokyo, Japan, processed 5,000 images. They just heard about us, and people would share. We would see on Facebook, we would put out, please help us do this, and we would see people sharing. This is really cool. See what's going on. And it produced not just this map of points where there's active drilling locations, but we believe it also provided citizen engagement, because as these people are going through the images, they're not only helping us do an image analysis task that's very difficult to tell a computer to do. It's providing a gallery, either of farmland and state forests that have been developed, and seeing these 5 and 10 acre industrial facilities in the middle of that, or area that hasn't been developed yet but is going to be, it's scheduled to be developed. And so by going through this gallery of images, it motivates concern about, is this really a good idea to be doing this? This kind of image analysis is very, the next one, is very simple. It doesn't tell us a huge amount of information that's new. It gives us a little bit of an idea better when things happened. The yellow dots, the very light yellow dots, are the very few wells that were drilled and visible as of 2005. all of the red ones was what was visible between 2008 and 2010. There's new imagery that was flown this summer, so as soon as the government settles its little budget spat, we'll be able to have access to the new 2013 imagery and process that for Pennsylvania as well. This gives us an idea where to go for more detailed analysis. Now we can ask, how big is the well pad? How far is it to the nearest house? Did you see wastewater ponds, or was it a closed circuit system? We can start to ask more questions like that. But it's not just asking citizens to help us do our work for us. We think that it's also important to provide notifications of things that we can't always get at or respond and investigate every single one. We created the SkyTooth Alert System, and I think that's a very valuable thing for journalists as well as citizens wanting to know what's in their backyard. It draws from mainly the Coast Guard's National Response Center, which is a federal repository for oil and hazardous chemical spills, as well as state data and a few select locations. And it puts that information, which is just a text form, you have to go, you have to query the database. If you find a report, it just tells you information in a plain text form. We took that information out, you can hit play on the video. We took that information out and put it into an interface that you can see on a map where the location is. It was a couple days ago, I looked and see that red dot there is one incident. That particular one was firefighting chemicals that had gotten into a stream. A lot of the stuff is fairly innocuous. It's a little bit of gasoline gets into a drainage ditch after an accident. But also, by putting it in a map like this, instead of having to hunt for it, those two reports are actually both from the same report. One person was saying a mysterious white substance is coming out of a railroad car. The follow-up report says that it was limestone from a car, door that had been left open on a railroad facility. That allows you to see in an active interface where these incidents are occurring, and we also allow you to subscribe. Suppose that you want to know this entire area of the Tennessee River watershed. You're interested in it. It's maybe your backyard. You care about it. You can subscribe to that area. Everything in that map window. If an incident occurs in that area, you enter your email address in the upper left-hand corner and hit submit. We will identify that box that belongs to you, and once a day, if there are any incidents that show up in the National Response Center or if you're in a state that we have other data for, you'll get an email saying, here's what happened in this geographic area. So that allows you to have a dynamic feed of information coming in. Here's what incidents are happening. And we find that that's very valuable for areas like Pennsylvania, West Virginia. We have drilling data included. Colorado, which recently suffered flooding, we also have data from their inspections and violation reports. So it's interesting to see when official reports go in, you can see at least how much the official report said was spilled or frozen wastewater was found in a drainage ditch or any number of things. And sometimes bigger issues come up. One example of the alerts is in the Gulf of Mexico. There was a vessel that came into port, and it said it was a workboat covered in drilling mud. We looked at that workboat, found its the track. Actually, satellites pick up a certain GPS transmission signal that a lot of vessels carry, traced it back to the rig that it was working on, and found a few days before that rig reported a pinhole leak and a few drops of drilling mud landed on a workboat below. So we connected the two. We're still trying to research what was involved in that, but it gives a tip to where stories might be developing. We've also done a big database of fracking chemical disclosures. This is not so much for the citizen scientists, although we have included that in the alert system. Technically, it's broken right now because the industry-funded website, FracFocus, for disclosing all of the chemicals, or at least the list that they choose to provide to the public, that site does not allow you to look at the entire database as a whole. We downloaded it and made it into an effective database, but the demand on the system from lots of people trying to research it has basically brought their system to a screeching halt, and so ours as well. But that's a very interesting disclosure issue. I'd be happy to talk more about that later. And then I'll leave those links up for a second. There's another side, and from my background working as an AmeriCorps VISTA in North Central West Virginia, there's a movement of citizens collecting baseline data. They're not so much out in the field expecting to catch a smoking gun of high conductivity from wastewater being dumped into a stream. But they are collecting data day by day about the environmental conditions of streams and waterways in their area. It's happening quite a bit across Appalachia. And there are other aspects of that, such as Aaron's going to talk about with mountaintop removal mining. But the point of that data is as a developing story. Not all of the data is in a good place yet because citizens have a hard time. There's not one good central place for citizens to submit their data. There are people working on that. We've contributed our ideas about it. But there will be, in the coming years, large troves of data about temperature and water quality, and that will be available to study environmental issues. And I can actually skip forward to the end. Citizens getting out and getting their feet wet, like I was a few years ago. And hopefully in the end, if they can see it, then we can all make changes.
All right. Thanks. Oops, where did my presentation go? All right, so my name is Erin Savage. I work in the water programs at Appalachian Voices. I work mainly on two different but highly related aspects. One would be clean water law enforcement, which we do a lot of in-house data research for that. And the second part is getting citizens involved in that process or generally involved in water quality issues, both surface water, mostly streams and rivers, as well as drinking water issues within the region. So we're a regional nonprofit based in Boone, North Carolina. We also have offices in Virginia, D.C., and Tennessee, and we focus mostly on coal issues across the four-state region, Tennessee, Virginia, Kentucky, and West Virginia. We also do some work with coal ash in other states. But my work is mostly directly related to coal mining, not so much the burning aspects. So before I talk about what I do with citizen science, I'm going to tell you a little story that illustrates why we work in citizen science and why citizen science is really necessary. And it ties in with citizen enforcement. So there's a really important part of the Clean Water Act that allows citizen enforcement of that act. You can actually convene a citizen suit against a polluter. It doesn't have to be done through a federal agency. So what we did back in 2010 is we decided to do a FOIA request for discharge monitoring reports, the reports that coal companies are required under law to provide to the state of their wastewater discharges from their surface mines and their processing plants. So we just picked the three largest surface coal mining companies in eastern Kentucky, and we requested their reports. It was really, really difficult to get them. So that brings about one issue with getting citizens involved. You know, you have to be tenacious, and one person by themselves maybe won't be successful in doing this, but as a group, possibly they will be, or partnered with an organization who can provide some support. So once we finally got these discharge monitoring reports, we did use an army of citizens to compile them because they were basically scanned PDFs from the Kentucky Energy and Environment Cabinet. There was no database. Kentucky did not have a database. So we got an army of interns, mostly undergrads, to hand-enter all of this data into Excel so that we could analyze it. And we got a pretty good clue of what we might want to look for when we were looking over these documents. So this is I want to put this in presentation. This is an example of two side-by-side DMRs, discharge monitoring reports. I'll do close-ups next. But you can see down below in the signature line, this one over here has a date crossed out. And so that was really easy to recognize, even as we were just flipping through them. We thought, huh, that's weird. You know, why would this be done by hand like that? So we went back and we looked at the previous quarter's report from the same sediment pond from the same mine. And basically, here's a little overview of what we found. So real quickly, a DMR, this would be your permit number up here in the top corner, and this is the dates, first quarter 2009. Down here, they name the outfalls. They don't have a particularly good way of naming outfalls in Kentucky. This one is just outfall one from a company called ICG. ICG has tons of outfall ones, so even determining which outfalls match what can be difficult. These in the red are the dates of the analysis done. You can see it's always on the 14th and 28th of the month. That was a little suspect as well. Everything in the green box is their data that they're required to collect, and a lot of this is they have permit limits under the law. So they have certain requirements for pH, for iron, for manganese. Some are just reporting requirements, though. And then down below, the signature of the manager that certifies that this data is true and correct. So then you go to the next quarter, and we've got same pipe, same permit, second quarter, different dates, still the 14th and the 28th. All 42 results exactly the same. You don't have to be a water quality specialist to know that this never happens. This is not possible. So right away, we knew what we were looking for. And down here, that crossed out date that clued us into this sort of issue. So this was the point we decided, let's put all of this data into a database so that we can just query it for all of the matches that exist for these companies, which is exactly what we did for ICG, International Coal Group. They're now owned by Arch Mining. Nally and Hamilton Enterprises, which is based out of Kentucky, and Fraser Creek Mining, which is owned by Trinity Coal, which is a subsidiary of SR Group, which is a big multinational mining company based out of India. And so through that, we found over 41,000 violations of the Clean Water Act between the three companies. And we took the data, and we initiated citizen suits against these three companies for the violations. The short answer is all three cases went slightly different ways. We had to deal a lot with the Kentucky Energy and Environment Cabinet. They were not exactly the most helpful partners. They wrote settlements with these companies and attempted to exclude us from these settlements. The settlements were based almost solely on the findings that we found. And we were allowed in state court to intervene on the settlements for ICG and Fraser Creek. We went into court-ordered mediation, and we were able to settle successfully with ICG. And they got close to $1 million in fines once you incorporate attorney's fees and things like that. But more importantly, we were able to institute a third-party monitoring requirement. So now they not only have the laboratories that they had been using for testing, but they have a separate laboratory that does split sampling, and they do analyze the data now, and then they send those reports back to me and my coworker Eric, and we go over that as well as sort of a fourth party. They have stipulated penalties for future violations. Fraser Creek's a little bit of a difficult story because they're in bankruptcy now, so our court proceedings are halted. And then Nally and Hamilton was our last case, and basically what the state cabinet did was enter that settlement in their own Office of Administrative Hearings Court instead of state court and signed us onto the settlement in name only with no meaningful participation. So Nally did get a $500,000 fine, which is the largest fine against a coal company for environmental issues in Kentucky, but still less than 1% that they could have paid under the Clean Water Act. So we have mixed feelings about how these cases have gone, but overall, you know, it was a big win. It resulted in a lot of changes in Kentucky and changes that are still ongoing in terms of lab certification and oversight. So just a couple of things real quick to show you about what we found when we compiled this data. This is conductivity reports. Conductivity basically is water's ability to conduct electricity, which indicates dissolved ions, dissolved metals, some of them harmful, some of them not. It's kind of an indicator. So you can see in the green box, these are the initial values in 2009. And they're all, you know, clustered around 1,000. They sort of inexplicably drop starting in 2010. This is still before we filed our lawsuit. I'll get back to why they drop here, but they drop to around 500. And then in 2011, this is right after we filed our lawsuits, and one of the first things the coal companies did was switch their laboratories to at least slightly more reputable labs. All of a sudden, we get more truthful data. I still won't say that this is necessarily 100% true, but certainly much more realistic. You can see some of the values even drop lower than they were before. So the more interesting part, though, is the drop in 2010. What happened here was that the EPA released their conductivity guidance for Appalachian streams on April 1st of 2010, and they said that conductivity for a healthy Appalachian stream should not be above 500 microsiemens per centimeter. So one argument would be, well, the coal companies read that guidance and they did the right thing and they immediately did something miraculous to bring these numbers down. A little bit far-fetched. On top of the fact that they were able to retroactively do this starting in January. But when you think about it, they report quarterly, so their reports for January, February, and March are not due until the end of April 2010. So it's pretty obvious here that they went back in these reports after reading this conductivity guidance and changed all of their data that they were going to submit for this quarter. So that gets me into citizen monitoring, because I didn't talk a whole lot about what we did with citizens in this project, right? But citizens really were involved in the background, whether it be through helping us to compile that data or through participating in our lawsuits. We had some individually named plaintiffs through Kentucky River Keepers, which is part of Water Keeper Alliance, signed on to this suit. And more importantly, the issues in Kentucky, they have not been fully fixed, nor have they been completely identified. And that's a really important area where we rely on citizens on the ground to let us know what's going on in their area, to look into whether it be paper evidence or on-the-ground river evidence, and basically tip us off for what we can look into. State enforcement tends to be much more robust when it's based on a citizen complaint and when that citizen or associated organization follows up on the response of the state. So that's where the ACE project comes in, which is the Appalachian Citizen Enforcement Project. These are supposed to be links. Let me just go out to the web real quick. So that is our joint monitoring program, which we do with several organizations throughout Central Appalachia, where we equip citizens with simple conductivity monitors. You just dip them in the stream, write down the number, and then you report it to this website. So there's a pretty simple online reporting form. And these are all of our current observations around Central Appalachia. So, right, just to orient you a little bit, this is the top part of Tennessee, and here is Southwest Virginia. You can see we've got a lot up in West Virginia and over here in Kentucky as well. So that really helps us to identify problem areas. When we see really high numbers, I can go out and do a grab sample. We can test for metals. We also use this aerial imagery to find out how close these observations are to discharges from the coal mines. And perhaps more importantly, it gets citizens involved. What I've really found in Central Appalachia is that folks are so used to seeing orange streams with no fish, and they don't know what to do about it, that I don't want to say they ignore it, but they're discouraged and they're disheartened, and they've sort of lost motivation to do much about it. So when we can get them organized and we can give them resources that re-energizes them to address some of these issues, especially when they know about the enforcement issues, the blatant enforcement problems going on with some of the state agencies. So then The other project we've just started is the Appalachian Water Watch Alert Site, which we've done in partner with SkyTruth. So David showed you the SkyTruth Alert Site. And what we did is we took that and we modified it a little bit and we refined it to not only bring in the NRC reports that he was talking about, so web scraping data. Here, actually, let me go here. Web scraping data from the federal pollution hotline. Those are all these red dots, and we've refined it to just be Central Appalachia. And then the blue dots here are first-party citizen-reported observations. So this may also go to the NRC, but people can report directly to this website or to a toll-free hotline we have. So a citizen report would end up looking like this. It ends up being a little more detailed than an NRC report. So you have a narrative description of what happened as well as photos of this train in the river here. This was up in the Brakes Interstate Park on the Kentucky-Virginia border. And then the map pulls up associated reports, so you can get updates as additional folks report on the incident or as NRC reports come in. So similar to the original SkyTruth Alert site, you can sign up for notifications through this site, and we refined it so that you can sign up for particular counties, or you can sign up for the entirety of eastern Kentucky, you can sign up for the entirety of central Appalachian coal fields. So there are two main purposes to this. Number one, allow citizens to easily share these observations with their neighbors and to do so anonymously. They're not ever required to give their names or any identifying info when they use the website or when they call me. Because a lot of times what we find is folks are also a bit afraid to talk to their neighbors about some of these problems. You know, coal is the dominant industry. And in some of these counties, gas drilling is also pretty dominant. But, you know, a lot of folks rely on the coal industry for their jobs or the state agencies that work with the coal industry. And so it's not always real easy to go to your neighbors and say, hey, I saw this spill. I know what company it's from, and it's a problem. But if you can do it anonymously and share it through the web, share it on Facebook, it's a little easier that way. The second issue would be get these reports out to the media quickly. A lot of times when people report spills to the state agencies, the state may or may not respond. You may not even know whether the state responds or not, especially if you call during the weekend or after hours. And the state certainly, at least in Kentucky and somewhat in Virginia, they don't go out of their way to publicize coal industry spills, gas drilling spills, you know, things like that. It's bad publicity for an industry that dominates the area. So we're trying to take out the middleman in this case, the middleman being the state, and allow these reports to get publicized more so that folks both within the area and nationally have a better idea about what's really going on with water quality in this area. Because it's not just an issue of minnows or even your charismatic megafauna. This is the drinking water not just for Central Appalachia, but for everything downstream. This is a huge watershed. This is, most of this eventually goes into the Mississippi, so this water goes a long way and through a lot of other states. And there are a lot of health impacts that we see in Central Appalachia right now, and it's very likely that a lot of that ties back to the water.
Thank you. We'll hear from Dr. Kasama next. By the way, I've got a more information sign-up sheet, which I will send emails out to everybody with URLs and other information. Bill, you want to help me pass that out while we're... Thank you very much. All right.
All right. Well, thank you to everyone for coming to our presentation this morning. I'm talking about citizen science from an African perspective. I usually define as outsourcing a citizen in the collection and analysis of information that helps us further our understanding of scientific knowledge. In as far as Africa is concerned, where I'm from, these are exciting times for citizen science. My own interest in citizen science was sparked by a class project that I did in Appalachia. And this particular class project involved the Virginia Creeper Trail. And the Virginia Creeper Trail connects Abingdon, Virginia to North Carolina. And so my class had been approached by two geographers, the Appalachian Community Service Learning Institute, and a couple of other people from the Virginia Creeper Trail Club that wanted us to gather information or data relating to the Virginia Creeper Trail. And this particular information that we're supposed to collect from about the Virginia Creeper Trail related to oral histories by older citizens that have actually lived in that area for most of their lives. And so one of those citizens, and what you see up there is actually a picture of my students. We had like I had 13 students in this particular group. And so what the students did was went out in the field at the actual Virginia Creeper Trail, and they were all paired up with some legend who had lived in the area for a long time to collect the oral histories. And so one such legend, and I have some pictures there, one such legend who's lived in the area for a long time, if I can get this up, is Lawrence Dye, who is actually known as the legend and the ambassador for the Virginia Creeper Trail. He's in his 80s, but hasn't had the opportunity of telling his story about the environmental and economic impacts that have gone over at the Virginia Creeper Trail, you know, the over the period of time that he's lived in that area. So the students, you know, got together with him, went to the Virginia Creeper Trail, and he pointed them to some of the vegetation that used to be there that, you know, is no longer there. He pointed them to some of his popular spots in as far as the biking on the Virginia Creeper Trail was concerned. He pointed them to some of the pictures that he used to take way back in the days, showing how the trail looked like back in the days compared to how it looks like now. And in terms of vegetation, a lot has happened. There's been a lot more development that, you know, has had like some environmental impacts. And so he walked my students through a lot of that stuff. And so after we completed this project, we decided, you know, what about my part of the world? What's going on in as far as citizen science is concerned? And so I will now talk to you about, you know, some of the exciting stuff that's going on my continent in as far as citizen science is concerned. There's a lot going on. These are actually very exciting times for citizen science on the African continent. I picked out a few projects that I found of interest. Most of them are based on the southern part of Africa. These projects include mapping of the Congo project that I'll show a video on that in a moment. There's a Serengeti project from Tanzania, which monitors wildlife in Tanzania and is actually hosted by the University of Minnesota. And then we have our own indigenous citizen science projects, such as the Southern African Bird Atlas project. And then we have what's also known as CRU, or Custodians of Rare and Endangered Wild Flowers. All right, let me show you a little video that was actually done by the SciDivNet on this particular project, the mapping of the Congo. And in the video, we see what was done in as far as this project is concerned, and we also see some of the challenges and successes that were brought about by this particular project.
Everyone can be a scientist. Citizen science calls on members of the public to help collect scientific data, often without the need for any academic training. While collecting data, citizen scientists can give feedback to the researchers about their findings. and contribute to the design of experiments, giving a voice to the needs of the local communities. The Extreme Citizen Science Group at University College London is a multidisciplinary team that works to bring citizen science to developing countries. For the last project, they traveled across Congo, around the area of Brazzaville, where commercial logging activities often have negative impacts on the life of local people. Jill Conquest is an anthropologist who took part in the expedition to facilitate the relationship between researchers and local people.
What we're trying to do with that is develop a software application that can be used by local farming and hunter-gatherer populations to map their local resources and to monitor the relations they have with the logging companies in their local areas. And part of the idea behind that is to try and match it up with some of the new laws that are being introduced as part of the requirements that logging companies are going to have to meet to sell their logs on the European markets, or their wood on the European market. Although the practices of the logging companies might be sustainable for the forests, there are people who live in those forests, and the work that the logging companies do might affect the livelihoods of those people unless the logging companies take into account that there are people living there, find out where the resources are that they use, and know not to go near those resources.
To help local communities to monitor the natural resources in the area and their relationship with logging companies, the Extreme Citizen Science team has developed a special mobile app that can work for people who are not familiar with smartphones.
I'm Michalis Pitos. I'm a computer scientist and currently a PhD student at the Excite Research Group. One of the biggest challenges that we had in this project was the literacy. So we had to overcome this challenge by designing more intuitive and more user-friendly user interfaces. For this purpose, we used simple drawings in black and white color, so it could be more easily understandable by the users.
The design of the icons used were tested in a field and improved using feedback from participants.
There is a particular icon in the software which shows a sort of this arch of leaves. Mm-hmm. And what it means is a sort of demarcated area of the forest where they put up these sort of arches for ceremonies to take place. Now, in one of the villages where we went, people had a lot of trouble recognizing this icon. And then when it finally became clear what it was, they were very happy. They were like, whoa. And my interpretation of that moment was that they were saying to themselves, like, whoa, this is really about us.
Users can describe different situations by selecting different categories and can keep track of the negotiations and promises of the logging companies.
At the moment, the logging companies are a lot more powerful than the local population who actually live in the forest. And the Congo is the whole region is quite well renowned for corruption and the sort of relationships between, the corporate entities and the government entities and things like that, which local people, just don't really have a say in any of these processes. Quite a lot of the problem in the Congo is not that the legal elements aren't there, but the bigger issue is enforcement of the law. The law is there, but there isn't necessarily anybody following it up. So this is why we want to go straight to the local people and ask them, has the logging company actually respected your resources, and can you tell us what it is that's actually happening locally?
The app stores information input by the...
All right, so that was a video about the citizen science project taking place in Congo, which has exciting consequences for journalism as far as the watchdog role function of journalism is concerned. And to quickly kind of go over some of the other projects that I came across that are really exciting, we have the Bird Atlas project from South Africa, actually run by the University of Cape Town. And as far as this particular project is concerned, it actually gives journalists an opportunity of using another set of data. In some of the sessions that we've had thus far, we've been talking about, you know, different ways of collecting data as journalists. And so this particular project in my map is not coming out. Actually, you know, they collect data as citizen scientists, and then that data is actually provided online for journalists to actually use in the actual reporting and coverage of different events. Yeah, unfortunately, my map is not coming up, but I was going to show. Oh, there we go. Maybe it's actually going to come up now. Oh, there we go. Yeah, so as you can see from the map, it gives, like, different entry points from citizen scientists that have, you know, collected data on bird sightings in southern Africa. And for each entry, you can kind of click on the number, and it provides you with actual infographics on what's going on in as far as different bird sightings in a given South African region is concerned. And they look at Zambia, Namibia, South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Swaziland in as far as this particular project is concerned. And this project has been running for about 20 years now, and a lot of interesting information has actually been collected in that regard. The other project relates to the crew project, but I guess I don't really have much time to talk about that. So again, with the crew project, which is run by the South African National Institute of Biodiversity, they have contracted citizen scientists to actually be on the ground and observe sightings of different types of wildflowers and how, you know, they are doing in that particular region, what problems, you know, people are seeing as far as, you know, certain wildlife, is it still there or is it disappearing, why is it disappearing, and so on and so forth. And then the Serengeti project that I had mentioned earlier, which is run by the University of Minnesota, involves citizen scientists actually identifying or classifying animals. What the University of Minnesota has done is they've put up cameras in Serengeti National Park, and citizens get involved by classifying the different animals that are found in the different pictures that from the captures of the project itself. And this is, you know, yet another exciting project in as far as the African continent is concerned that journalists can actually use in their actual reporting. And it seems like my internet is a little bit slow. And to quickly go on to the final project that I'm really excited about, it involves reporting of HIV/AIDS. There's a group of journalists that have come up and set up a network of journalists living positively with HIV/AIDS. And so far, they have about 700 members. And of that 700 members, about 5 of them are actually from Zambia. And I know them, you know, personally. And these particular journalists use the network to crowdsource in as far as reporting of HIV/AIDS information is concerned on the African continent. So some of the journalists that I'm talking about include Enoch Ngoma, who's actually the news editor at the Times of Zambia, and he's taken advantage of the fact that, you know, he is a journalist living with HIV/AIDS, and he's also a member of the network of journalists living positively with HIV, and so he uses the network to not only crowdsource and get story ideas for his reporting on HIV/AIDS, but also gets, you know, citizens involved that actually have HIV/AIDS in, you know, the reporting of HIV/AIDS. And then I also have a picture here of another journalist from Malawi who is also a member of this particular network, and you know, does the same thing that Enoch Ngoma does in as far as this particular network is concerned. So I guess I'm running out of time, so I'll just end it there.
We are running short on time. We have about 15 minutes left, and I'm wondering if there are questions from the audience. Bill?
Sure, I'm Bill Allen, and I teach science and environmental journalism at the University of Missouri. And
absolutely fascinating. I wonder, for those of you who, you all wrestle with this issue, how can you know that the data that citizens gather is accurate?
All right, so the question there was, how do you know if citizen data is accurate? The short answer is that you don't necessarily, but there are best practices that you can use to ensure data quality. So for the ACE project, collecting citizen river data, that's the reason that several groups got together to work on the project was to combine best practices and standardized equipment used and standardized trainings. So that goes a long way to help to make sure that citizens know how to use their equipment, are using good equipment, and collecting good data. But we're not going to use citizen-collected data for a lawsuit, for example. But like I had said earlier, they may indicate to us where a scientist could go out and collect a grab sample or something like that. But more importantly, a lot of citizen projects that I'm involved with, at least, it's not as much about the data as it is about the citizen involvement. I'm much less concerned about whether the data is absolutely accurate. I'm more concerned about getting folks out into the rivers.
In my case, and as far as the projects that I looked at are concerned, they are all in collaboration with academic institutions. You know, we had like University of Minnesota, we had Cape Town University, we had London City College. And so, you know, once you have like an academic institution, you know, backing the citizen science data, it, you know, gives you more, you know, a peace of mind that, you know, this data must be accurate. So.
And with crowdsourced image analysis, which includes the Serengeti project, is applying having multiple citizens go over the same image. So, I mean, that's you cannot ever have 100% certainty, even with a professional. But we found that if 9 or 10 of 10 agreed on what the image was, we had 99.99 something accuracy on identifying wells compared to our analysis. So, repeated application of that when you're doing analysis tasks. Is a way to be more certain of the accuracy.
So you can go back over and repeat the same observations and cross-check for accuracy between the groups?
Yes, yeah.
That's an old technique, too. Great. Other questions? And, again, Bill did it perfectly. Identify yourself and then ask your question. Thank you very much.
Yes. How would you be able to protect your sources, especially like with the Mackie Congo project, you're going to communities that they're up against the logging companies, like in very close quarters, and they're sending this info to you. So is there any way to kind of protect those sources? Are they able to contact you guys? I mean, and also with the water testing. I mean, I don't know how much of an issue it is in the States. I know probably much more so in Zambia, but is there anything you can add to that?
That's a great question. I guess they're somewhat protected because they use like cell phones to get their information across, and so they don't really have to identify themselves. And that having been said, sometimes I think there's no need to actually, you know, protect themselves in as far as, you know, identifying themselves is concerned, because the project gives them ownership of the problem. And so, you know, if you own a problem, like there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, actually being identified as, you know, being an owner of that problem. So, yeah, some kind of turn, you know. Like, on the one hand, they can protect themselves through sending the text messages by phone when nobody sees them. But then on the other hand, this is their problem, and so they want, you know, to be heard loud and clear and actually be seen, you know, as doing something for the project.
So that's a really great question about the anonymity of your citizen scientists. It actually is a big issue in Central Appalachia. There have been plenty of cases of mountaintop removal coal companies using intimidation against citizens who try to fight back against permits or against pollution issues. For the citizen monitoring project, on the website, everybody is given an anonymous username. I do have lists of who these people actually are, so I won't claim that it is 100% foolproof for something like a hacker, but we're hoping that bad companies wouldn't actually go that far. But that's actually one of the big reasons that we started the water pollution alert site. One reason would be that, people may be intimidated to get involved with river monitoring in these areas. I mean, sometimes you've got coal trucks driving by and hazing you, basically, because they know, they know me when I'm out with my monitoring equipment. But the other reason is there's a bit of a barrier in terms of time and effort that people are willing to put forth. So the alert site, it allows people a bit more anonymity. They're not actually out testing. It could be while they're driving to the grocery store, they see a sediment pond spill because they drive right by it, and then they can call me anonymously. And so that the anonymity aspect is a big motivator behind that project.
Very interesting projects, thank you. To what extent have journalists been interested in using these techniques in your research? It seems like if citizens can do it, journalists can do it. I mean, to get good stories out of it, but I've seen a lot of interest from local journalists.
One thing I would point to, the question was, are journalists making use of these citizen science activities and projects? One project that we put up in the aftermath of the BP spill was a Gulf oil tracker, a Gulf oil spill tracker, allowing citizens to submit reports of pollution and where oil had been seen coming ashore. And that was based on Ushahidi platform, which I believe, I forget what country that started. It was initially designed to track voting and social issues in Africa, Kenya. And that platform, we were able to use that, and one citizen actually, by herself, continuing to monitor the beaches of Florida, kept finding tar balls, kept reporting them to our system, which journalists were following, state regulators were following. They were getting the alerts out of them saying, tar balls this size, photos uploaded, saying it's continuing to be a problem. And that kept BP active cleaning up for far longer than they would have otherwise. So I think that is one example of journalists making use of that. But it does take, I think, an effort to get these projects more out and get more reports populated in your system, for example, mm-hmm. really push that out.
Right. Just another thing I would add. We, at AdVoices, we have a few more local journalists who really help us out with our stories, especially some of these legal cases. We have not seen a lot of journalists going out and mining this data themselves. It is a bit labor intensive, and the water quality, the aquatic chemistry can be a bit intimidating. That said, one of the things we're really thinking about these days, I brought up that last legal case, the Nally and Hamilton case, was settled differently in a different court, very much limiting our ability to get a good outcome out of that. And that is one reason we have not pursued additional cases in Kentucky, if they exist, because we're just not sure that we can get a good outcome, at least given how much pursuing a legal case takes in terms of time, money, resources. So at least in my opinion, the next best thing to do with those sorts of findings are to get them to journalists and to publicize that and put these companies in the court of public opinion. So we're really looking for that sort of involvement.
We've seen a lot of interest, particularly in as far as the network of journalists living with HIV/AIDS. Part of it is because, that's a topical issue. In my part of Africa, the HIV/AIDS prevalence rate has been pretty high. Zambia has about, a 13.5% of, HIV prevalence. And so the citizen science project to that effect has actually been very, interesting and informative for journalists. Enoch Ngoma from Times of Zambia that I was talking about, he actually started a column on HIV/AIDS in the Times of Zambia based on, the crowdsourcing that he's, gained from the citizen science project. So he's been helpful based on the topical issue of HIV/AIDS.
The question was, have journalists come to us operating these different programs requesting assistance with the program? And absolutely, that on our end, some of it has been driven on our end, but just recently a public health, Johns Hopkins, has come to us requesting assistance studying air quality in the Marcellus Shale region, wondering about what the proximity of ponds and evaporation from that, what that does to the health data that they have. So we have received requests on that end. And in other instances, usually it's just, have you seen anything on an image or a report? That's mostly what we've seen so far.
We have some of those partnerships as well, the most common being just providing water samples to universities that are doing similar sorts of analysis. The central Appalachian Mountains are extremely difficult to drive through. It's a fairly large area, and it can take a long time to drive, just 30 miles. So that's a big hurdle in terms of collecting data. So as much as we can share those efforts, the more data that we can get. The other big aspect there, and this really comes into play with citizen monitoring, is finding people that maybe have that contaminated well or have access to the discharge that comes from a sediment pond. Often these are from valley fills that are up back road haulers, and somebody lives right below them, because we as nonprofits and universities as well, unless they jump through some hoops, we can't just go on to the mine property. So sometimes gaining access to areas where we can sample relatively close to these areas is important, and that's something where we can be helpful to other projects in terms of just putting people in contact with one another.
Hi, I'm Wonder. Freelancer out of New York. Although in the context of this group, I'll also mention I'm an author with O'Reilly and Maker Press on books to build, how to build your own environmental sensing gadgets. And Bill doing that almost just right from the question earlier. I'm really pleased to see you all talking about this here. Because I've used SkyTruth's reporting or data on the oil spill when I was writing about the Gulf oil spill in 2010 at Honor Magazine, and it really led, I think it that me and other people using that data, and then therefore you all collecting and disseminating that data, really forced the issue in terms of BP and the government opening up their process to journalists. There were a lot of problems with getting access to good information. So I just want to say that I think we're doing a very important thing there for journalists, even if it seems like the news hasn't gotten out yet that much in the journalism community. I just wonder, though, where do you see, other areas of application for the kind of data analysis that you're doing? I mean, it's sort of extending eyes. That's essentially the sensor that you're extending. And I wonder, do you anticipate being able to do other kinds of data gathering over time, chemical analysis or just other kinds of more subtle conditions with the technology that you're using right now?
With citizen science, absolutely. I've certainly seen numbers of groups that are starting to get people in the field doing that. There are certain limitations to what drones or balloon mapping, that was one recent experiment we had some fun with, I think air quality is one that possibly could be in the near future if groups like Public Laboratory are doing a great job of getting kits together for how to fly certain instruments and put those together.
The other big one that I would bring up that we do work on at Appalachian Voices, but it could always be improved upon, is gathering that baseline data, whether it be well water data or stream water data, before extractive industries come in. That's something that's really lacking. And when that baseline data is not there, legal challenges in case of contamination become much more difficult to win, even if you know just from the obvious that something has been contaminated by the extractive industry. Without that actual data, numeric data evidence, it becomes much more difficult. So that's something that I would like to see grow, and that would be applicable to a lot of parts of this country and other countries as well, not just for mountaintop removal, but gas well drilling and other industries.
Maybe I should say, Dr. Kasoma, what's next for Africa, and then we'll wrap it up and head for lunch.
Okay. What's next for Africa? I guess the air quality issue that has just been raised. Africa has now become more or less a dumping ground for, cars that are no longer usable in this part of the world. And so with that transpiring in Africa, we also have, carbon emissions that, are bad for the air quality for that part of the world. So I think that would be a good project for Africa. So, yeah.
Well, I think we've had some excellent speakers today and excellent questions as well. Let's give ourselves a